This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of August 13th, here are some top stories. In the news...
Whether you were born here in Arizona or came here from somewhere else, chances are you have wondered about the people, places, and things here in the Grand Canyon State. Well, KJZZ is investigating your questions as part of a brand new project we're calling Q&AZ. KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports first on the complex history of Indian School Road.
Our first question comes from Adam Watts, who lives in Chandler.
How did Indian School Road get its name?
If you couldn't guess, Watts is a transplant to the Valley.
I'm from Queensland, Australia, in Brisbane.
On vacation with his family in Washington, D.C., he went to a museum where he saw a photograph of Native American girls in white dresses kneeling in prayer beside their beds.
And on the caption, it mentioned that that was taken in the 1900s. Early 1900s at the Phoenix Indian School. And I found that pretty striking.
The name of the road is a literal reference. Phoenix was the site of one of more than 300 boarding schools for American Indian children. The history of these schools goes back to the late 1800s. It's complicated and, for many, painful.
So this first part is the homeland section.
At the Heard Museum, you can walk through an exhibit that traces both the history of the Indian schools and the journey of a student. Curator Janet Cantley says the federal government took children from their families and sent them to schools hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles away.
As the children arrive to the school, there is the process of civilization. And again, this is the 19th century vocabulary.
This language is uncomfortable, and it reflects what people in charge believed at the time. The man who founded the boarding schools wrote you had to, quote, kill the Indian in him and save the man. And that often started with a haircut.
You're confronted with a barber chair and the sound of clippers, and you can see hair strewn on the floor.
Throughout the exhibit, you hear the voices of people who survived these boarding schools.
The fact is that we were to be transformed, and short hair being the mark of gentility with the white man.
Up the road 2 miles from the Herd at Steele Indian School Park, you can still walk through parts of Phoenix's boarding school. I meet Patty Talahongva in a red building that was once the elementary school.
Hi, everybody.
Yes, come on in, Mariana.
A larger-than-life black-and-white image of young girls with bobs cut at their chins and boys with tucked-in shirts greets you at the front door.
Some of the boys are making silly faces, like, you know.
Like she's really picking her nose?
Yeah.
These were first graders at the school in 1951.
The boarding school story is not one story. It's not a story only of tragedy. It's not a story of everything that was okay. It's very personal.
Assimilation was the main goal in the early days, followed by teaching the students to work.
It wasn't so much an effort to truly educate the kids so they could go to college and be their own business owners and have professional lives. It was an industrial school, and the boys were taught trades.
In later years, Native Americans took more ownership of the school. Talahongva came here as a student in 1978.
My younger sister came to school here with me, and she actually had her band class in this building, in this room where we're sitting right now.
It was here that she got her first paying job as a journalist. Talahongva points out notable people who were students at the Indian school, like Ira Hayes, one of the Marines who helped raise the flag at Iwo Jima in World War II, and musicians who found a passion in the school's band program.
I want people to realize that, and this goes for Native Americans, I want people to realize that Indian people are strong, you know, we're resilient. We figure things out and we face adversity and we overcome it.
The Phoenix Indian School closed in 1990, just shy of its 100th anniversary. Tomorrow we'll explore the answers to what happened next and why the fate of one part of the property is still to be decided. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
Things are happening, Father. Bad things are happening, and I don't know where to turn. The bishop has told me I must marry tall, but how can I marry a man I do not love?
The opera is grand, beautiful, and of course, dramatic. And so are the costumes that help tell those classic stories. Designing those costumes for an opera is an exercise in historical research, pattern making, and artistic license. And for Arizona Opera costume designer Kathleen Trott, it's a creative endeavor. I recently got to go behind the scenes in her costume shop at the Arizona Opera to see how it all works and was met by what looks like a craft room filled with racks of grand dresses, piles of dress forms, colorful materials, and rows of sewing machines. Today, they're making a probably 10-foot-long dragon puppet for an upcoming educational production of The Magic Flute that will travel throughout the state, as well as a medieval-looking hat for one of the characters.
So this is Papagena's hat. The idea was that Papageno and Papagena were sort of gently chicken-themed. So we took historically accurately shaped hats. So this is a hat that's similar to a medieval hat. It will end up ultimately looking like an exaggerated Robin Hood hat. And then we're going to crumple it down when it's real fabric and sew it so that these crumples end up looking like the little combs on the head of a chicken. So it's still a medieval hat, but it looks a little bit like a chicken.
Okay, so we're pinning this now. This is the pattern.
So these are the patterns. So Lauren has pinned it all out. She's made sure that her grain is correct. And then she's going to mark where she's gonna cut. And she will cut it out and then we can sew it together.
Trott grew up in the theater, but she says it wasn't always obvious to her that she would end up working in the theater. I sat down with her in the costume shop and talked more about what led her to this role and how she approaches designing for the grand opera stage, like she did last year for the Arizona Opera's original production of Riders of the Purple Sage, which was adapted from Zane Grey's famous Western novel.
It's one of those things where in high school, everyone was always like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I didn't know because I wasn't excellent at any one specific thing. I was good at lots of things, and so it made it really hard to narrow it down. But theater, being good at lots of things, makes you excel here because you have to be able to problem solve, and you have to be able to research, and you have to have an artist's eye, and you have to be able to work really well with others and be flexible about your decisions, and you have to enjoy being part of a greater sum than yourself, because the art that we make in theater is much bigger than what any one person could ever make, and it's a separate thing. So if my costumes look beautiful, but they look awful in front of the set, I haven't succeeded, and it doesn't matter that up close they're gorgeous dresses, because they're not serving the purpose of the play. So that's part of the thing that I like about theater, is that it's very give and take. So I have to make something that works with other artists as well.
So let's talk about your role here and about what it means to design costumes for the opera in particular. So for a show like Zane Grey's novel that you adapted, you get the script eventually, I'm sure. You listen to the music, you talk to the director. Where do you approach the costume making? Do you start with the time period?
For that sort of show, yes, because it was set in a time period and it was very specific. And I got the libretto and the music as it was being made. So I saw it earlier in the process and could sort of progress, and I could look at the notes and be like, oh, this is kind of grand sounding, so my costumes can't be small and tiny because then they'll be drowned by Edmel's beautiful set and by this epic movement that's happening in the music. If my costumes are all flat and tiny, then it won't match, and it will be very disconnected on a sort of subconscious level for the audience. They would be like, I don't really know why I didn't like that scene. Often they can't tell, but there's something that doesn't ring correct for them. And that's often actually one of the things that makes people not like a movie or like a movie. You don't know why those costumes were weird, and it's because they were completely historically inaccurate.
So it has to do with the authenticity of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So it was really important for Fenlon Lamb, who was the director for Riders of the Purple Sage, that it feel real on one hand, especially because our set was so sort of grand and Edmel's style is really true to what you see, but it also is beautifully stylized. And so she really wanted the costumes. They needed to be real people who lived in front of this beautifully epic scenery. Then, when we decided that, I went to the historical source material. So, costume sketches, they have all these fashion plates that were done in the 1900s and in the 1800s before we had a whole bunch of photography and things like that. And so we looked at those. And so we started looking at shapes and silhouettes and movement. As a group, we went out to the desert where this show actually takes place. We got to take a really great trip out to Pipe Springs National Monument, which is believed to be the basis for Jane's house in the novel. And while we were out there, we were talking about the fact that, you know, in Zane Grey's novel, Jane's house is filled with women from town who work, who help her, because she's running a whole ranch and you can't run a ranch with just one person. So what I decided I wanted to do was express the fact that as the story goes on, the women and the minority in that town get more and more oppressed. So they lose some of their individuality. And so the women start out having a little bit more color in their palette, and they have more trim, and their shapes are a little bit more individual, still within the time period, but distinct. And then as the show goes, they change costumes, and they become dark and drab, and they look very similar. And you can't really tell the difference between one or the other in the back of the stage as it's dark when the scene is happening, because they're no longer individual humans. They've been sort of suppressed down.
So that's part of it too, though, right? Like the fact that these are not, they're historically accurate, but these are not costumes like for a movie. These are costumes you're gonna see from far away. How do you costume for that? How do you design for that?
So because our stage is bigger than a movie, it means that often our choices have to be heightened. So in a movie, a dress that has a little tiny pinstripe would have a little petite trim, and it would be lovely, and you'd see it, and it would be great. But that little pinstripe and that little trim will get lost on our big stage under the really high wattage lights that we use. So our trim tends to be slightly bigger than what the normal trim is, and it gets to be a little bit contrast, so it's a brighter white than it would have been because the cream would have washed out, or there's a little strip of color in with it.
So listening to you talk about this is so interesting, mainly because I think it's so much of what you're saying is about the unconscious half of this. Like, you're not the singer on stage, you're not the principal cast member, even the director, even somebody making the sets, right? This is the stuff that, like, literally is on the people who are telling the story. What is it about the costumes that you think makes such a difference to the audience, even though they may not always realize it?
So part of what I like about making costumes as opposed to the set is that costumes are very close to our hearts. We may not realize it, but when you go to your closet in the morning, there is a reason why you put on the thing that you put on. Clothes say so much about who you are, even if you're not trying to make them say anything. The thing that has to ring true with an opera or with a play is that the job of what we do is to bring fictional people and circumstances to life as if they were real. And so that means that in order for those characters to be real, they then would have had to have gone to their imaginary closet and stared at the options available to them and decided what to wear on that day. Today, they have to look really great because whoever's coming over and they're trying to impress them, what's their best suit to pull out of their closet? Or we, being the designers, know that something really tragic is going to befall this person. So in order to heighten the tragedy, we need to make them be presented as hopeful and young and innocent to begin with, so that when it's all stripped away, we can see on their outside the difference, because that's what happens to real people. So like with Riders of the Purple Sage, part of what we were trying to tell on a more quiet level was that when men abuse a governmental or religious structure for their own gain, it's not true to what it was originally set up for, and it hurts all of the small members, small being minority, not actually worth less, of a community, which we felt was very poignant and still continues to be so in this day and age.
When I was a much younger man, and I loved her more than any woman I ever knew.
And often what makes people, I think, really love opera is that we tend to get to see the really tragic outcome of it. So we can have that catharsis. And the films that win awards, and the books that we love, and the music that we really love, all does that on some level too. It touches us, and every time we come back to it, we take something different and new out of it, and it connects us all.
Kathleen Trott, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein with a discussion on the Invest in Ed plan.
There's near universal agreement in Arizona that the state needs to increase funding for K-12 education, whether it's to get back to pre-recession levels or if it's more ambitious than that. But the proposal to increase taxes on the state's wealthier residents is where the dramatic disagreement starts. So is there some common ground to be found when it comes to Invest in Ed? Maybe not. But if the measure makes the ballot and an ultimate outcome puts about $500 million toward public schools, that path is a lot smoother. With me to talk about Invest in Ed and what could or should come next are economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting and Sam Richard of Creosote Partners. Sam, let's briefly start with why you think the Invest in Ed income tax approach makes sense.
I think that it mostly affects the people that have benefited from the economy that Arizona has built over the last 30 years. The Invest in Ed campaign, the Invest in Ed committee, really believes that those are the people who we should ask to shoulder the burden for really something that our politicians have created. For almost every single year over the last 30 years, we have made significant cuts to our state's revenue. And to start to chip away at those cuts, we have to, you know, look at the options that we have on the table. And income tax is one of those options. Property tax seemed greatly politically untenable. And we have one of the highest sales tax across the nation now. So starting to look at that income tax was the way that the campaign decided to go.
Jim, digging at a couple of levels, but first of all, at the basic level, the approach of raising the income tax on a very small percentage of the population.
When we talk about the economy, we have to talk about there's a lot of things that matter. And unfortunately, in politics and even public policy analysis, it's hard to get people to focus on a number of things at once. So really, we have to have competitive taxes. We have to have responsible regulation. We have to have investment in K-12, but we also need to maybe spend a little bit more money on the universities, which I support. We have to worry about transportation. I feel like we have the same argument that we should be investing more in education, and I said this publicly quite a bit. It's really a matter of how we get there. And one of the reasons that I'm concerned about this particular proposal is it's a very volatile a source of revenue, which is going to cause some fiscal problems. I spent enough time working in budgets that I can see some of these coming. And it's the first time that I've actually heard my economic development colleagues worried about a particular tax provision, because usually they understand that there's a lot of things that matter. This is the first time where we've been hearing directly from people that I trust and other people outside the state, this could be an issue.
Jim, is there evidence that folks making $250 and above, whether they should have their taxes increased or not, is there evidence to suggest that these are, in fact, the job creators in Arizona? Certainly a percentage of them are, no question. They're small business owners, they're CEOs, whatever it may be.
I think it's a component. And when you look at some statistics, people can kind of pick and choose, and I've seen extremes on both sides. And the ones that stood out to me, at first I wasn't really buying into the small business component as much. But thinking about how I set up my business, I'm not at that level where it's going to matter. But I going through the process, I understand how it works. Talking to accountants, understanding that, yes, this is how people are going to transfer their residency, and then they'll come back and things will move around. And so there is that additional risk, but it's hard to monetize it. If you look at the overall data, the higher income groups, about a quarter of those file as, and I'm rounding, but about a quarter maybe file as the small business category. Where I worry more, though, is of the small businesses, about 90% of the taxable revenue comes from the higher income category. So it's a concern. The math to me indicates that it's a concern. And that's not even the thing that I'm most worried about. Is there a chance that we could slow our rate of job growth? Very minuscule changes in our economy have dramatic consequences. That's my biggest fear.
Yeah. We're going to go big picture as far as what the next steps could be, but I have to ask one real specific political question. Sam, I'll start with you, Jim, if you want to weigh in. We talked about the Red for Ed effort and the 75,000 people marching at the Capitol. Does this show a lack of leadership from the legislature that a proposal like this has to go forward? Or, Sam, is there something else politically going on here? I mean, is there a step where if the legislature had seen the light in the eyes of the Red for Ed movement, that this wouldn't have happened?
Yeah, I think that, of course, right here in the immediate moment that we have, I think there's a very valid case to be made that this governor and this body of the legislature has failed Arizona's public schools. But I think that you're right to point back and look, you know, two decades, three decades ago, where really the seeds of this discontent were planted. I think what you're seeing now here are individuals like me in my mid-30s who I went to well-funded schools. And now I have a 2.5-year-old and I'm thinking about sending her to a public school. And the public schools that my daughter has access to are completely different than the public schools that I had access to when I was in elementary school and high school. And the fact of the matter is that this is a politician-created mess, and we cannot depend on politicians to fix that mess.
I'm a little more optimistic only because we spent so much time after the last downturn figuring out what we were doing wrong. And Sam's right, we were focusing on we can promote our weather, and everything was about a tax reduction. But again, in my opinion, it gets back to balance. You have to, businesses like stuff, people like stuff, but you can be responsible and analyze it. Here's what's difficult. You know, the reason that we have elected officials is that in theory, and you know how I feel about elected officials on occasions, in theory, they would be going through this discussion with people from both sides, and we brainstorm, and maybe we come up with what would be optimal, and then we would convince them, it would get tweaked a little bit and implemented. Now, that doesn't happen. But then we go to the other extreme, which is the initiative process, and I do not think that the typical person is listening to this story about Sam's argument of, I feel like we need to do something, or my argument of, you're only going to get about half of the raise you want. Here's the math. Try to figure it out and maybe even get some input if there's town hall. So on these really big things, we need a better process, but I don't think it's from being beaten down over time working in politics, but I don't think that that'll happen, but maybe we can make it happen a little better going forward.
Are you saying you think that businesses like the Chamber of Commerce and whatnot would only support a sales tax increase at this point?
I think that affects their membership a lot less than an income tax on those at the highest levels of income.
I think it has to be a package that's very thoughtful. And so doing some analysis, I do not think we'd have negative economic consequences if our sales tax went up by 0.5%. Once you get up to another percent, you start to think about whether or not you could have, you know, the negative consequences to consider. But we have other things that are potentially on the table. Some are going to be politically viable, some aren't. But we have the whole tax conformity issue. We have the ability, based on that Wayfair case, to maybe tax some of this these interstate transactions. When I add these things up, I get to plenty of money for what we're talking about. We're talking about $1.5 billion. I still feel like we may be on exactly the same page on the amount of money that we would like to get there, because the stuff that I was thinking about is even more than what's in this Invest in Ed. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it won't cause the economic harm. But I still understand the issue of if people don't trust the process.
Jim, at its core, though, do taxes have to go up in some form or fashion to make any of this possible? And this isn't even really as much as a lot of people would like to see as far as extra funding for K-12. is it enough to get back to pre-recession levels, or do we have to be more ambitious than that?
We have extra revenue coming at the state. Mm-hmm. That doesn't last forever. So I feel like part of that is accounted for in the 2020 plan, and I've already said that. But I do think that we may have to consider that very modest increase in the sales tax. There's different ways where you can make adjustments in the tax base where you're not making it as regressive on the lower income. There's different things you can do. But I think that this is the opportunity because of these other things that have presented themselves mm-hmm. to do it right. But yes, why can't we be even better? I don't think that we should just say we have a goal of getting to X year in terms of revenue. It can be, what do we need to have a good package now, 5 years and 10 years? And we don't think long term in the state as often as we should.
Mm-hmm. To Jim's point about that we need a balanced package, I think part of the reason why we haven't yet really been willing politically to have that conversation is we've only looked to our politicians to have that instead of having those thoughtful discussions around what the balanced approach is. Right now, as a per share of income, if you break it down by $100, the lowest income folks in Arizona pay $12.50 of that $100 in taxes, and the highest 1% still is at about $5.50, right? So as a percentage of income, taxes are still much higher for those on the lower end of the income scale than those who have benefited most from our upside-down tax system.
I still feel like, based on what I'm seeing, the ability to have conversations like we're having right now, I have no doubt that if it fails, we can put together a rock-solid plan. But the key, I think, from the other side is they need to feel comfortable that people are committed to that plan. Because give me a month, even working with Sam, I bet we could come up with a plan that is great if this failed. But do you get policymakers on board? Are people going to back it? This is one of the few times where I am nervous about how would I quantify some of these impacts. I don't want to be an alarmist, and I never am, but I am very much concerned about the economics. But I still feel like the conversation that we're having needed to happen, and sometimes you have to have that little fire to start things.
Jim Rounds, economist of Rounds Consulting, Sam Richard of Creosote Partners. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the Fronteras Desk. Here's KJZZ's Kendall Blust in Hermosillo, Mexico.
Mexican officials said earlier this year that a highway improvement project in the northern Mexican state of Sonora was slated to be completed by the end of August, but Sonora's governor says that's not going to happen. The project includes improvements to the entire 400-mile stretch of highway from the U.S.-Mexico border in Nogales to Sonora's southern border with the state of Sinaloa. About 70 miles of the project are still unfinished, mostly in the northern section closest to the border. In May, the head of the Federal Transportation Department said he wanted construction completed in August, but Sonora's governor now says that's impossible. But that deadline was just supposed to speed things up, says Francisco Javier Hernandez. He's the transportation director in Sonora. He says the real goal is to finish the project before Mexico's current president leaves office at the end of November. Kendall Blust, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Arizona Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis.
A University of Arizona-led study may help scientists agree on the contested timing of one of the largest volcanic eruptions of the last 4,000 years. The massive Bronze Age explosion that collapsed the Greek island of Thera also spread ash that dimmed the sun across the eastern Mediterranean, a physical layer by which scholars could link the histories of many ancient peoples, if they could only agree on when it happened. But archaeological data and radiocarbon dating argued for different dates, 30 to 140 years apart, until a team led by UA tree ring expert Charlotte Pearson helped close the gap.
The dating range that's presented by this data is one that is wide enough for it to run into that period of overlap with some of these other lines of evidence which haven't previously overlapped.
The Scientific Advances study updated the tree ring data on which the carbon-14 dating was based. I'm Nicholas Gerbis in Phoenix.
From the Business Desk, we reported on the complicated history of Phoenix's Indian School, the namesake for the well-known road that cuts through the heart of the city. Now KJZZ's Mariana Dale investigates another question about the future of the land that made up the school.
The Phoenix Indian School shuttered in 1990, closing the book on a complicated 99-year history. That created a conundrum. What to do with 110 acres of land in central Phoenix? The answer is also complicated. There were years of negotiations. In the end, here's who got what. The Veterans Administration got land to expand the Phoenix VA hospital. Most of the Phoenix Indian School property went to a development company called Barron Collier in a land swap for some Florida wetlands. Barron Collier in turn traded 57 acres to the city for land closer to downtown. Phoenix went on to create Steele Indian School Park, and Barron Collier was left with 15 acres on the corner of what is now Central and Indian School. And that lot has sat vacant for the better part of the last 26 years, except for a few years when the city of Phoenix ran a community garden there. This brings us to our next question.
Marietta, this is Wayne.
That's Wayne Mitchell who submitted the question. Why doesn't the city clean up and use that large vacant piece of land?
It's discouraging and depressing to see the potentiality of that land, and it's just becoming an embarrassment.
He says he's tied up emotionally about the property in part because he taught at the Phoenix Indian School.
I want to see something good happen to that area. And in particular, I'd like to see something that the entire city can be proud of.
The simple answer is that the city of Phoenix doesn't own the property. To find out who does, I talked to Ryan Boyd. He's the communications manager for the Maricopa County Assessor.
The assessor's office's job is to locate, identify, and value all the property in Maricopa County so that we have an accurate record of all property and what it's being used for and who owns it.
On the assessor's website, I found out the property is owned by Central Park One LLC. Here's how that came to be. As part of the land swap deal with the feds, Barron Collier agreed to pay almost $35 million into a fund for Native American education. It stopped making those payments in 2013, and as a result, the feds took back the land. The government sold the property for $18.5 million in May.
Good morning, Pivotal Group.
Central Park One LLC is connected to Pivotal Group, a Phoenix developer. Their CEO confirmed they are developing plans for the property, but declined to speak about them. So what will happen to the northeast corner of Central and Indian School? Phoenix's planning and development director, Alan Stevenson, explains what the zoning here allows.
It calls for the parcel at the northeast corner of Central Indian School to be a intense mixed-use project that will have apartments, offices, retail uses, as well as some urban open space, parking. We're talking about heights in the 200-foot range.
When I told Wayne Mitchell about this, he was disappointed. He thinks the land should become an extension of the park. Coincidentally, 18 years ago, the editorial board of the Arizona Republic argued the same thing. The paper read,
"Office towers rising out of park space cannot be good land use."
Mitchell and others I talked to also want to see some acknowledgement of the property's history as part of the Indian School. Stevenson says the city's aware.
We have had one initial meeting with the developer where we did talk with them about trying to figure out a way to incorporate some of that as well as connections into Steele Indian School Park.
This is the most attention the property's had in years, but it's too early to predict exactly what will be built on top of a place that still generates complicated feelings in so many. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.